I managed to leave my digital recorder at home this morning, and so when I realized that, I went up on the Android market and downloaded a voice recording application for my cell phone, and we will find out when I play it back how good a job that does. But I do find it interesting the degree to which the cell phone is now taking over. I'm no longer bothering to bring a camera because it does an adequate job of taking pictures of the whiteboard for my purposes, and we will see whether or not it's an adequate substitute for a digital recorder as well. As usual, before I start talking about stuff that I thought was interesting in what you've now read, let me first give you people a chance. What things struck you that you thought were interesting or you didn't understand you wanted to discuss or whatever? Anybody? Yes? No? Maybe? We were discussing mostly the Hod, the Quranic punishments before. We then have several other kinds, and the other two that are really part of Sharia are Tazir and Jiniyat. Maybe I should actually write those down, assuming I got it. That the Tazir are the discretionary punishment offenses, and the, see how it's spelled, the Jiniyat are the ones which I interpret as the revised version of the old blood feud system that the Arabs had had before Muhammad. So in the Tazir, the judge gets to decide on whatever basis he likes, more or less, as far as you can tell, the punishment, and the punishments range from privately telling you that you've been a bad boy up to cutting your head off, up to execution. And there is some dispute as to whether fines are a legitimate punishment under this system. What are reasons that one might have reservations about making fines a punishment that a judge can impose? That fines on the face of it seem like a really good idea, because when you cut somebody's head off, nobody else gets another head, whereas if we fine you, then someone presumably the state has the money. Yeah. Well, of course, the judge could always adjust the fine. In Finland, traffic fines are defined as a fraction of your income, with the result that if the president of Nokia, or I don't remember if Nokia is Finnish, but a sub-major Finnish firm, gets a traffic fine, it might be $50,000. Once in a while, one sees a news story about that. What else might concern you about judges having discretion to impose fines? Yeah? I'm not sure why there's any more potential for bribery. After all, I'll bribe you not to cut my head off, too. But I'm worried about a different kind of corruption, namely that the fine is a source of revenue to whoever is receiving it. And you could certainly imagine a system where, the government's short of money, and so they pass the word to the judges, fine anybody on any excuse, we need the cash. And in a sense, you do, one of the things you want to think about in all these systems is not only the incentive to the criminal, you're trying to give people an incentive not to do bad things, but also the incentive to the law enforcement system, that they're people too, and you want to worry a little bit about rules that make it too easy for whoever is enforcing the law to benefit himself and his friends at the expense of other people. In order to convict somebody, you do it either on a confession or with two witnesses. Some of the schools hold that one of the witnesses can be a woman. For various of the other rules, it's got to be two adult male Muslims. And the confession is not retractable for Tazir offenses. And there are a variety of different offenses, things like perjury, usury, slander, and also the various things that are covered by the Quranic rules in situations where the Quranic rules don't apply, or you don't meet all the requirements for those rules. Apparently, false accusation, I guess of sexual offenses, I'm not sure of other things as well, against a non-Muslim is not a had offense, but is a tazir offense. So it is still something you can get punished for. The people know what usury means? Yeah, usury in this context means any loan at interest. In modern usage, it generally means excessive interest as defined by someone or other. So the U.S. states might have a usury law saying you can't charge more than 10% interest, say, or some other amount. However, both medieval Muslims and medieval Catholics held that any charge of interest at all was at least immoral, if not illegal. Medieval Jews held that any charge of interest to a fellow Jew was illegal and immoral, which may explain why Jews tended to be a source of loans to kings and other non-Jewish borrowers, since they were pretty much the only people in the medieval Europe who, under their own rules, were entitled to loan money at interest to anybody. I don't know where this rule comes from, ultimately. Part of the justification, I think, in Catholicism went back to Aristotle, who argued that that money was by its nature barren, that if you had cattle, they would reproduce themselves and increase. Money just sits there, and therefore it's somehow wrong or perversion or stealing or something to take interest for money. Howie explains the problem where I use my money to buy a herd of sheep and then the sheep increase. Why isn't the guy who provided the money entitled to some of that increase? I don't know. We'll come back to this issue with Jewish law, because with Jewish law you have some fairly sophisticated discussions of ways of getting around these rules and of trying to prevent ways of getting around these rules. And in particular, Maimonides, I think, distinguishes between sort of violations of the rule against usury, strictly speaking, and the sort of weaker kind of violation where he thinks it's wrong, but it's a way of avoiding the prohibition. Comments, questions, anything on that? So, all right. The next, and to me rather interesting, set of laws is the Janiyah, which, as I say, looks an awful lot like what happens to something like the Icelandic system once Muhammad gets a hold of it. That the blood feud itself is not supposed to be happening. In the very early Islamic history, you see some cases of people sort of killing someone else on some excuse when there's some kind of a conflict between them, and is this or not permitted, and, you know, does Muhammad believe the guy who says that he really did X, or the other guy who says, no, he just hated him and wanted to steal his wife, and that part depends on who gets to Muhammad first in order to give his story. But in any case, let me see if this is still working. Unlike a blood feud system, you do have to have a trial. Now, of course, in the Icelandic system, they also have trials. That was sort of a blood feud system with courts. In the Roman child gypsy system, you don't. And then the amount of punishment depends on what the offense is. And basically, there are three potential punishments, and those are retaliation, blood money, and penitence. And the retaliation is more or less literally eye for an eye retaliation. It basically says, you have done something to me. Under some circumstances, the court will let me do the same thing to you. If what you did to me was to kill me, under some circumstances, my closest relative gets to kill you. And there is actually an interesting story. There was a North African Muslim in the 14th century, the name of Ibn Khaldun, who went on the pilgrimage to Mecca and Medina from North Africa and got bit by the travel bug. And he made a decision that more or less swore an oath that he would never, if he could avoid it, go back by the same route he went out by, which I think is sort of neat, and I sometimes try to follow that rule. You see more that way. And he ends up wandering around the Middle East, visiting various places, and finally he hears that Muhammad ibn Tughlaq, who is the Sultan of Delhi in India, is very generous to foreign legal scholars who come to his court. And Ibn Battuta, I'm sorry, I mixed them up anyway. Ibn Battuta, is that right? One or the other of them. Again, no, it's Ibn Battuta. He is a legal scholar. And so he sets off for India and travels through southern Russia and I guess what's now Afghanistan, and ends up in Delhi, and spends some years as the chief Molokai judge of Delhi under Muhammad ibn Tughlaq. And he then is sent on an embassy to China, and it's not clear that he ever gets to China. He says he gets to China. We've got this very detailed sort of memoirs that he dictated in his old age, which is how we know all of this stuff, and it's really very interesting. It's sort of a picture of the 14th century world as seen by a 14th century Muslim. And he says he got to China, but that part of his account apparently doesn't fit very well to what else we know about China at the time. So there's some suspicion that he gets partway to China and something goes wrong and he comes back, and eventually he manages to get permission from his boss to go home, and he comes. Oh, before that, he's gone down the coast of East Africa. He's our only source for East Africa in the 14th century. And he comes back home, and he goes finally back to North Africa, but of course he can't stand still very long, so he goes down the coast of West Africa, and is our only source for West Africa in the 14th century. And he finally goes home, dictates his memoirs, and dies. But one of the bits of his book, which is four or five thin volumes of translation, is his account of his boss, of Muhammad ibn Tughlaq. And it takes the form of good things about Muhammad ibn Tughlaq and bad things about Muhammad ibn Tughlaq. And one of the good things is that on some occasion Muhammad struck a young man when he had no legal right to do so, and the young man sued him, took him to court. And Ibn Battuta tells us the Sultan did nothing to try to stop the lawsuit, and the judge held that the young man was entitled to choose between a money payment and retaliation. And the young man struck the Sultan in the face. I saw his turban roll upon the grass. And it's clear that Ibn Battuta both approves of Muhammad's behaving this way, of his not trying to use his power to avoid the legal implications of that, but also regards it as unusual. And I thought that was sort of neat, because it's, in a sense, an issue that runs through modern political ideas as well. To what extent is the ruler bound by the same rules as everybody else? And, you know, on the one hand, there's this doctrine that you presumably all know more about than I do called sovereign immunity, which basically says that you can't sue the U.S. government unless it says you can. On the other hand, you know, Clinton got sued, and there was an impeachment trial, and various other things happened, so we do in some sense believe that even if you're the chief executive, you're still under the law. I thought it was sort of neat to see that back in the 14th century in India, that same tension existed between, on the one hand, the idea that the ruler ought to be bound by the same law as everybody else, and on the other hand, the suspicion that most of the time he wasn't. Yep.
So we know this guy, was a Muslim, was he also an Arab?
Oh boy, that's an interesting question, and the answer is that I simply do not know. It wouldn't be surprising if he was by descent. That is what you were going to say? No. That basically there has been a Muslim conquest of roughly the northwest corner of India. This is pre the Mughal emperors, if you're familiar with them. They were coming from Central Asia, so they clearly weren't Arabs. But this was sort of the Muslim dynasty before that. And he had come, you know, he could have been Persian originally, because that's the nearest Muslim state, as it were. So I just don't know whether he was the descendant. There was, I think, a more or less Arab or Arab and Persian army that came in early on and conquered some of those areas, but I just don't know enough about it to know what he was ethnically. But at least legally speaking, he was Muslim, and he had all four schools of law, and one of them he had our friend Ibn Battuta as the Qadi of. So anyway, but I thought that was an interesting incident. But in any case, so you have the possibility of retaliation, and in three of the four schools, you only have retaliation if the perpetrator, if the victim was at least the equal of the perpetrator. And what does equal mean? It means free man, free man, and it means Muslim, Muslim. So if you committed such an offense, if you were a Muslim and you committed such an offense against a non-Muslim, presumably there might be consequences, but the consequences wouldn't be retaliation, if I understand the rule correctly. And if you committed against a slave, then the same thing. That's in three of the four schools. The Hanafi did not make that requirement. And I gather did hold that if a free man killed someone else's slave, he could be subject to physical retaliation. And then be killed, I guess.
Well,
though. And notice that unlike our kind of criminal system, the punishment depends on the victim choosing it. That is to say, if you injure me and I say let him off, he's off. I presume, though I don't know, that I could say to him, give me 100 dinar and I'll let you off. I don't know what the rule is on what the English would have called compounding a felony, that is, settling out of court for such a thing. But clearly I could just decide I don't want to do it for whatever reason. Maybe because I'm a merciful guy, maybe because I'm afraid that you'll hold a grudge against me and you and your friends will hurt me in some future context, or you know, accuse me of something, or not buy from me, or who knows. But in any case, it is unlike our system. Now, to what extent, it's an interesting question, in our system, to what extent do you think the same thing is true de facto? That if you are assaulted, and they find out who did it, and you say, I feel sympathy for this guy. You know, he's a poor immigrant. I don't want him to spend time in jail. In practice, do you think that the police will abide by your... Any opinion? Yep.
So it's kind of a crime.
Yep.
You know, sometimes the state prosecutes for their own sake, like the domestic
abuse. Yeah. I was actually thinking of a story my son was telling me last night about Burning Man. People know about Burning Man? That, by his account, the people who were involved in the original creation of Burning Man are very unhappy with people who now run it. They think it was sort of taken over by slimy types. And one of his stories was that the Burning Man evolved out of various sort of street theater kind of people who were doing things like climbing the walls of buildings that they had no legal right to climb and stuff of that sort. And apparently at some point in the last year or two, someone at Burning Man tried to set the Burning Man aflame earlier than it was supposed to, several days earlier than it was supposed to. He didn't succeed. And my son's view is, well, you know, that's the sort of thing people, the founders were doing. They were, you know, street theater, as it were. The guy was prosecuted and ended up in jail for, I think, a year or two sentence. And my son's view, at least, is this shows how the people now running it have basically betrayed the spirit of the original event and are, you know, locking people up for the sort of thing that the original founders would have themselves done. But that was sort of an interesting case. And I know, you know, you have department stores that say we prosecute shoplifters. So I think that in practice there's a significant element in modern legal systems of if the victim does or doesn't push for it, what happens. But it's, I don't think that formally there's any such requirement. Of course, in the civil law there is. If you don't sue, if somebody gets a tort against you, no one but you is obligated to sue him. So in that sense it looks more like tort law than criminal.
You can pick what kind of remedy.
In civil.
Yeah.
That is, to some extent, you can ask for injunction versus damages, and you can settle out of court. It's perfectly legal to settle out of court in civil. So it is legal to settle out of court in criminal, too, but who has to do the settlement? Not the victim, the prosecutor, right? That's what we call a plea bargain, yeah.
I don't remember the video, but how did they solve the problem of somebody not bringing a case with a threat from the agency?
That's the same. Don't know. Might easily have happened. You could certainly see if you were beaten up by someone and you knew that he had contacts, you know, who were politically powerful and lots of tough friends and you were nobody, and you would say, well, yeah, I could get permission to beat him up too, but it really isn't very clever. And what you might do in that case is, again, out of court settlement. You might go to him and say, look, I'm feeling very generous. I realize that you're a good and noble man, with some expectation that he would then feel an obligation to give you some money or, you know, find you a job or do something nice for you. I don't know. And then, so the first one is retaliation. The second one is the equivalent of the Icelandic weregeld, blood money, where weregeld specifically is blood money for killing somebody, but there were penalties for smaller offenses as well. And in that case, in some circumstances, basically the victim or the surviving relative of the victim was dead, could choose. He could say, I want retaliation or I want blood money, as in the case I was telling you about Ibn Battuta. Whereas in other cases, the nature of the crime was such that he didn't have the option of retaliation, and therefore blood money was all he could get, or penitence. And oddly enough, the blood money, there are two fixed payments, both of them defined in camels. and it's a certain number of camels, but I think they're female camels of some particular set of ages, which presumably affects the value of those camels. I've got actually quite a good pre-Islamic story, which if we end up with extra time at the end, I will tell you, because it's one of my favorite stories from that culture, which ends up with basically a war being settled by appropriate payment in camels, but more than 300 camels, but a good deal in that case. It's basically the Arabic version of Trojan Women, if you know Trojan Women, in the Greek play. And the money has to be paid, I gather, by the relatives of the offender. I don't know to what extent they can require the offender to pay it or not. And the amount depends on the victim and on the crime, so that the full amount is basically what you have to pay for killing a free male Muslim, provided that you end up with blood money rather than retaliation. You then have two categories of non-Muslims in an Islamic society. You have dhimmi, which is what you and I would only be if we were living in an Islamic society, and less for Muslims, which I'm not. That is, it is a non-Muslim who is protected by treaty, a non-Muslim who is living in Islamic territory as sort of a little bit like the resident aliens in Athens. He's a legal part of the society, but a sort of second-class citizen. The dhimmi, there are various rules. The dhimmi were required to pay a poll tax, a certain amount each year. On the other hand, they were not subject to the equivalent of the draft, that whereas a male Arab might be required to join the army under circumstances, a dhimmi would not be so required. And there were various other restrictions varying in detail according to when and where in Islamic history. So that sometimes there was a limit on how long your turban could be if you were a non-Muslim, or whether you could carry a weapon. And I think the usual rule was that Christians could repair churches but could not build churches. So there were various restrictions of that sort.
Restrictions on how could these dhimmi, were they Christians and Jews? Or
typically, yes. Well, this is a little complicated. Some people hold that only the four tolerated religions were to be permitted. And I think other people hold that that's only true in Arabia and not in other Muslim areas. And the four tolerated religions are Muslims, Christians, Jews, and something else. And there is some ambiguity on what the something else is. And I think the most common version is Sabaeans. And the Sabaeans were, I think, a Jewish offshoot considerably earlier than Islam. And in fact, there is a story, which I think I have from a 9th or 10th century source, about the real Sabaeans and the swamp Sabaeans. And the story is that there was a group of pagans living in a swamp somewhere within Islamic rule, who nobody paid much attention to. They weren't important people. And someone finally noticed them and realized that they weren't members of any of the tolerated religion, and so they were sent a message from the caliph telling them they had a year and a day to either leave or choose one of the four tolerated religions to go to. Well, they had a problem, so they made investigations. And they discovered that everybody knew what the Muslims believed. There were lots of Muslims, and there were some Jews and some Christians. Everybody knew what Jews and Christians. But nobody knew anything about the Sabaeans, except that they were the fourth religion mentioned in the Quran. So when the messenger of the caliph returned for his answer, these people said, "We have decided to be Sabaeans." And they proceeded, according to my source, with the same religion they'd had for the last, whatever, 500 or 1,000 years. Or anybody came by and asked them what it was. And, "Oh, this is the Sabaean religion." And so he explains that even to this day, there are two kinds of Sabaeans, the real Sabaeans and the swamp Sabaeans. But in any case, and I've seen it both asserted that this is true of any area ruled by Muslims and that it's true of only within Arabia. Yeah.
It can't be for any area ruled by Muslims.
It clearly was not actually enforced.
Right.
That doesn't mean that isn't what the rule was.
Okay.
That we have the big case would be Zoroastrians, I think, were driven out of Persia. I don't think
they're still there practicing today.
Maybe they are now, but I believe it is the case, though I may be mistaken, that at the time of the Muslim conquest, I think that's where, what's the community in India? There's a community in India, I've now forgotten what they're called, who are in fact, I think, Zoroastrians, or at least one of the variants of the Persian. yeah, I now forget what they're called. And I think they were, I think, refugees from the Muslim conquest. Yep. I've seen, I think there are a bunch of different rules, and I think it really depends who you believe, when, and where. There are a group of these which are referred to as the Covenant of Umar. Umar is the second caliph. And I gather it's now believed to be fictional. But the story was supposed to be that Umar sent this message basically to, I guess, by the Byzantine cities that are thinking about surrendering. Here are the terms of surrender, and, you know, we agree to protect your people and not kill you, but you have to pay us the poll tax, and you can't carry swords, and you can't try to convert Muslims, and you have to, in various ways, sort of defer to the Muslims. But within that deference, you're allowed to practice your religion. And that's called the Covenant of Umar, and it probably was invented after Umar was dead, but there are different variants of that, you see. And I think Jews were supposed to have, I think, yellow turbans. In fact, you've got a whole color coding system, and I'm not sure to what extent it's enforced, but it shows up in the Thousand Nights and a Night, because there are a bunch of people who've been transformed into fish, and the colors of the fish reflect whether the people were Jews, Sabaeans, Christians, or Muslims, which I thought was sort of neat. But anyway, so you did have at least the three the four tolerated religions, counting Islam itself, within Islamic territory, and those would normally be the Dhimmi. There's also, yeah?
I was going to mention, when I lived in the Middle East not long ago, and we had to carry insurance, auto insurance had to include blood money.
Aha.
And the first line worked for European banks that was also doing issuing insurance.
Yes.
In the country. And they had this table that they had to relate to their European headquarters of how much blood money what kind of individual would be.
Yes.
Right. What kind of victim.
That's right.
I remember that being quite a... Europeans could not get their head around.
Yes. Well, the rules, at least according to this, are, in addition to Dhimmi there, what they refer to as Mustamin, which are basically visiting non-Muslims under safe conduct. For them, most, three of the four schools say that the cash payment for them is either half or a third what it would be for a Muslim. And again, the Hanafi are the holdout, so they say it's the full amount. And then there's this odd, but sort of in a sense sensible, proportional rule, which says that if it's 300 camels for killing you, then it's 150 for losing an arm or a hand, and it's 30 for losing a finger and so forth.
This is definitely more than that.
Yep.
And I'm amazed our concern that it's proof now for nationality and income.
Oh, it's my sex also. I didn't mention, sex is half as much for a woman as for a man. But nationality rather than religion?
I think so.
English and French cost different amounts? Where in the Middle East were you?
In Dubai.
Aha. All right. Did they distinguish between their own citizens and other Muslims?
Yes.
Yeah, that might be.
I'm pretty sure that their own citizens were the
most expensive.
Value.
Right.
And then I think they probably distinguished between Eastern and Western, and then laborers, for sure.
Yeah. Although some of the laborers might be Muslims, of course, if they were coming from India or Afghanistan.
Yeah, but I think very much that they were the same, values the same
as the local Muslims. Yeah. They may well not have been. I mean.
Yeah, it was just because they're, laborers, usually replaceable.
Yes.
I think the justification modernly was what would be the income loss to the family.
Uh-huh.
And it's,
Well, that's, of course, the modern theory. That is one of the bizarre things about modern law in the U.S., for example, is that the value of your life is zero to you.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say that the way our law, tort law I'm now talking about, for wrongful death law, the amount owed is the injury to other people from killing you, not ignoring the injury to you from killing you. So if I understand it, at least in theory, if you're a loner with, no family and no dependents, and somebody tortiously kills you, well, too bad. Your claim died with you. If they tortiously injure you, on the other hand, you can collect damages from them. That's sort of, I've long argued in the sort of running dispute in law and econ as to whether the common law is economically efficient. That's one of the clear cases where I think it isn't, because we know people are valued to themselves, and therefore there ought to be a penalty for carelessly killing someone, even if no one was injured. Yep.
That wasn't at all.
we want the penalty in order that they won't be gone. That is, from the standpoint, at least from the usual law and econ perspective, the reason for the penalty is not to compensate somebody. We do that with insurance. The reason for the penalty is so that people will have an incentive not to be careless for other people's lives.
Well, where would the penalty be paid to if there were no people who were losing?
Could be a fine to the state. It could go to make him a beautiful tombstone. Could go to his estate. He can have a will, and maybe goes to a home for lost cats that he lost his money for. But you could certainly have, or it could go to his family along with the damages for injury to them. Right. And you could have both.
So isn't that the cat?
What?
Isn't that kind of justification for the criminal system? If it is about imposing punishments, then that's what the criminal system is for. But the criminal system, in a way, avenges.
Except that the criminal system does not count tortious loss of life. There are requirements for the criminal system, such as intent, which wouldn't apply in the tort case. There are other differences as well, of course. You might do that, would depend on the circumstances.
And the verdict, I suppose, is entirely different. Instead of making something else whole, it's actually punishing the individual.
Yeah.
So even if the making of the other party whole is meant as a deterrent, it's still a different sort of burden.
But in any case, take my law and econ class next year, and we can discuss this in much greater detail, because it's an interesting set of questions. I mean, I've long felt that one of the really intriguing set of questions that doesn't get explored much in law school is the whole tension between tort law and criminal law. That, do you need both systems? Well, no, you don't, because the guy's workers manager is only one, and so do the Chinese, just different ones. Is it desirable to have both systems? Does it make sense to have the differences that there are? Is there a good reason why criminal conviction is beyond a reasonable doubt and tort conviction is by preponderance of the evidence? A whole bunch of differences, and that, I think, is an intriguing question. But as it will, take my course next spring, and then we can go into that, because I spent a chapter on it. Or read the book, which is on the web. Anyway, so certainly the basic rule is a certain number of camels, 300 or 200 depending on the case, for an adult free male Muslim, half or a third that for a female, half or a third, or just half, I've got a note. Half that amount for a female, half or a third that amount for a non-Muslim, and for injuries short of death, it's scaled down by what proportion of the relevant data of the person has been lost. So half for a hand or an arm or a leg. You might say, well, there are limbs, it ought to be a quarter, right, for a hand, but that's not the way they do it. A tenth for a finger, and so forth. Then the third possibility is just penitence, and as we discussed before, the impression one has is that that's not usually mandatory, though it may sometimes be, and the penitence consists either of freeing a Muslim slave, which presumably is a little hard to do nowadays, since I'm not sure there are any Islamic societies that admit to having slavery, or alternatively fasting for 2 months, where the fast means abstaining from food, drink, and sex during daylight. I think that's the way the Ramadan fast, I believe, is defined. And as I said, those who are entitled to these things can forgive them if they like. Questions, comments, anything interesting, discussing on that? All right. They have a variety of divisions of homicide. Some of this stuff we're going to see again in the Jewish law in terms of under what circumstances am I how liable for death or injury to somebody. Is it the same thing if I go after him with an axe? If I, hit him with a stick of wood I'm holding, trying to hurt him but not trying to kill him and he dies? How about if I simply dig a pit and carelessly leave it uncovered and he then falls into it and dies? Or how about if you dig a pit and you prudently cover it with planks and I want to see what it is, so I take off the planks to look and I forget to put them back on, and then so forth. So as I say, when we're reading Maimonides, at least depending on which parts of it you read, you can get quite detailed, fine discussions of exactly the different kinds of liability. But in this case, the first category is willful homicide, which is at least pretty close to our first degree murder, where it's deliberate. It counts as willful homicide if you're only trying to wound him and actually killed him, provided you were using a weapon that is the kind of weapon that kills people. So if I attacked you with a sword, and I wasn't really trying to kill you, I was trying to teach you a lesson for being so rude to me the day before, but I happened to get careless and I kill you instead of just cutting you up a little bit, that's willful homicide. And on that one, the punishment is either retaliation, your heirs get to kill me, or the 300 camel, the larger version of blood money. And there are then some other categories which may or may not count according to the school. One which I sort of like is death due to false testimony. And I don't think that's true here, but suppose somebody is executed, and suppose after he's executed it is determined that one of the witnesses whose testimony was essential to getting him executed testified falsely. Are there any criminal penalties? Perjury, I guess. But that's it. The case I was thinking of, actually, is, as you may know, there was a scandal some years back about a DNA lab in Texas which had been cooking their results. That is, they hadn't really been doing the tests, and they'd been telling the police what the police wanted. And if I understand Islamic law, if anybody was executed, since it was in Texas, people probably were executed, those lab technicians were guilty of murder and get executed themselves, assuming that the heir of whoever got executed wants to be executed. Yeah? But all of those sanctions are a whole lot lower. Yeah. No, the case that first struck me along these lines was the black Muslim shooting in Chicago. I don't know if any of you remember, it was a long time ago, probably before some of you were born, but I was a graduate student in Chicago, and there was a case where, at least according to one side of the story, some policemen came to the door of an apartment filled with sleeping black Muslims and opened fire, and two people were killed. And the police, of course, claimed we came to the door and knocked, and somebody shot at us from the apartment, and we shot back, and we didn't get killed. And I mentioned to a friend of mine whose politics were much more left-wing than mine that I could certainly believe Chicago police would lie, but I could believe that black Muslims would lie, too. I had no way of knowing. And she told me that the black Muslims were offering tours of the apartment. So I went and looked. And it turns out that when a bullet goes through a wall, you can see which direction it's going because the splinters are pointing one direction. It was all incoming. There were no outcoming shots. And that was the eventual conclusion. And as far as I know, none of the police involved ever suffered any legal penalty. The district attorney who had been in charge of the raid was charged with obstructing justice and trying to cover it up afterwards, but I think got acquitted. On the other hand, there was a civil case, and the county and state and city, I think, ended up paying sizable damages to the survivors. So that struck me as an interesting case of sort of the tension, the weakness of criminal law as a way of disciplining the authorities, as it were, because they're controlling the criminal law, and at least you've got some better chance with civil law, since although it's still in the government courts, the prosecution is being done by private parties, not by the government. Yeah?
Given that perjury here, I think it's just one of the most common least prosecuted.
Yeah.
So do we know whether that astoundingly harsh law would actually apply?
I don't know. I think it's an interesting question, and if I ever come across a case, I will. But no, I do not know if it is. And according to this, it was only in some of the schools. That it was one of these many issues on which the schools split. Then there's a weaker version, which they're referring to as quasi-willful homicide, which is the same thing where you're hitting them with a baseball bat rather than an axe, but you're hitting them with a weapon that. Supposing that baseball bat is usually not lethal. Maybe I'm wrong, but hitting him a weapon which could kill him but probably won't, as though there's a presumption you weren't trying to kill him and just got lucky or unlucky, according to how you look at it. And in that case, if you kill him, it's the same as willful homicide, but if you wound him, of course, it's only wounding. Then there's the accidental homicide case, and the accidental homicide case does not have retaliation. Accidental homicide, I gather, covers either the case where you were not trying to, you know, where it really was an accident in the normal sense, but also the case where you thought you were acting legally. If you imagine the person where some drunk guy comes into your house when he thinks he's going into his house and you think he's a housebreaker and, you know, he's holding something and you think it's a gun and you shoot him, that presumably would be their accidental homicide. You did indeed intend to use a lethal weapon, but you thought you were entitled to in self-defense. And you can make a variety of other cases. Yeah.
Given that this is like a religious blog or a big question, do they ever, do you ever see any writings about how they deal with the fact that when a penalty for like a crime is killing someone, like how they don't do that any different?
Why should
they have the option?
Oh, yeah. I mean, almost all legal systems have the lack of capital punishment in modern developed countries is a very unusual phenomenon, historically speaking, right? So why? But besides, there's nothing wrong with killing people in most religions, as long as you're killing the right people. I mean, after all, you're required to go on jihad to conquer the Christians and bring more areas into the land of peace, into Islam. So it's not just killing people is bad. I mean, we don't generally think of soldiers who kill people, who kill the right people. I mean, if you kill civilians by accident, that's a no-no. But if all you're doing is killing enemy soldiers, then you're a hero. You're a good guy. That's true of almost all systems. There are a few exceptions. Quakers don't feel that way. You know, the story about the Quaker who hears a noise in the night and he gets his trusty blunderbuss and he goes down and there's a burglar going through his silverware and points the blunderbuss at the burglar and says, "Friend, I wouldst not harm thee for this vile world and all that is in it, but thou standest where I am about to shoot." Which again raises some interesting questions of just how you define murder or not murder, or killing or not killing.
That's a lot like the poet who's allowed to get drunk and not allowed to, but nobody's going to arrest
him. Yeah.
The same sort of wrangling that goes in that thing.
Well, there are quite a lot of, if you look at some of the stories sort of around Harun al-Rashid and his judge, there's a lot of mental gymnastics of various sorts, one of the settings of some of them is that somebody, when he's drunk, swears an oath. And he's bound by the oath, he wants to get out of it. And then the judge has to figure out a way that he can successfully, you know, do such and such, neither standing on the ground nor in the air, neither this nor that, and so forth. I don't remember any of them anymore, but they're sort of anecdotes of legal trickery, the sort of thing you'll be in the business of doing. The sort of reason the Chinese regarded lawyers as legal tricksters who should be punished. For accidental homicide, they don't kill you. You pay the smaller of the fines, the 200, I think, camel instead of 300 camel, if I remember correctly. And in some versions, you're supposed to do an act of penitence. You're supposed to free a slave or fast for 2 months. And I should say I've also left out the fact that in some of these cases, you also lose the right to inherit from the person you killed, which presumably most of the time doesn't matter, but you could imagine a case where you killed a relative and you're his heir. And then one of the schools, the Hanafi, have a couple of additional categories, one of which is the one is indirect homicide, where you dug a pit, presumably with no evil intent, but then someone fell into it and died, and what's liable for them. And as I say, you'll see those in the Jewish law. Many of those, it's not a person, it's a cow fault. What extent are you liable, under what circumstances do you owe damages for the cow, and that gets complicated. So as I was saying before, all of these, the charge has to be brought by the victim or his nearest relative if he's dead. It still has this sort of civil law feel to it, as it were. And there, one odd bit is that according to the school and circumstances, there are cases where there isn't enough evidence by itself to convict, but there's some reason to think you're guilty. And if 50 people who are not witnesses swear you're guilty, you're guilty. And it's unclear to me whether these are 50 people who claim to have some knowledge of it, or it's just if these 50 people, you know, think they know you well enough to know you're guilty. And then according to a different school, in this situation, it's if 50 people swear you're not guilty that you get off, and otherwise you get convicted. So that reminded me of the business in Jewish law, where in some legal contexts you can swear and be quit, meaning be acquitted, and in some legal context you can swear and take, meaning swear and win a case. And those are normally what we would think of as civil cases between two parties. Notice, however, that Texas is a good Muslim state, that under the Muslim law, homicide and bodily injury are excusable if the person you killed was your wife, daughter, or sister, and that person's lover who you discovered engaged in unlawful intercourse. So if you come in to find your wife with her lover and you shoot them both, that's just fine. You probably didn't shoot them until late in this period. You needed a sword. And in fact, there is the scene very near the... Have any of you ever actually read The Thousand Nights and a Night? The real thing, that is. Yeah, but yeah. Because as you may know, the very near the beginning, one of the two kings who are the central figures at the beginning comes... He's about to go off to visit his elder brother, who's the, sort of the senior king, and he goes back into his... He's got the caravan with gifts and stuff all ready to set off to his brother, and he goes back in at night to get something he forgot at the palace, and he finds the queen, his wife, on his own carpet bed, making love to a black cook from the kitchen. And at that, the world turns black before his eyes, and he takes out his sword and divides the two of them into four pieces, and then goes off and is very miserable for a long time, thinking about how terrible it is that his wife has been unfaithful to him, and that's sort of part of what leads into this whole Shahrazad story, where the other king, when he discovers similar things about his wife, decides that the way of never having a wife unfaithful is that each day he will marry a virgin, that night evade her of her maidenhead, on the morning have her executed, and thus he's going to be safe. And this goes on for 3 years till he runs out of virgins, and at that point you've got Shahrazad volunteering to be his next wife and then telling stories for the next thousand nights and a night in such a way that he never wants to have her executed because he wants to hear the punchline of the story. This is sort of the ultimate use of cliffhangers, and that's the thousand nights and a night, which is great fun. The Arabian Nights, if you get a book called The Arabian Nights, it's probably not merely a small fraction but heavily expurgated, because the real thousand nights and a night, although I don't think I describe any of it as pornographic, is sexually pretty explicit, what seemed appropriate to a different culture. Oh, and you're also permitted to kill male non-Muslims who refuse to either pay the poll tax or convert. That is, ones who are not obeying the conditions under which they're allowed to live safely and under Muslim rule. There's then another issue, which some people consider a hot offense and some don't, and that's apostasy. Read up. And that basically is the Muslim who renounces Islam. That the normal rule is that it's perfectly legal to be a Christian or a Jew or a Sabaean, provided you pay the poll tax, but that it is not legal for a Muslim to become a Christian, Jew, or Sabaean. They aren't allowed to try to convert, and people aren't allowed to be converted. Some people hold that to be a capital offense. Some details differ. There's some argument as to whether that's a Quranic offense or not. Apparently the Quran says basically you're going to go to hell if you convert away from Islam, but doesn't actually say you should be punished for it, and therefore it's held by some people to be a later addition. But that, of course, is one of the issues that in modern conflicts with more or less fundamentalist movements within modern Islamic states becomes a live issue. If somebody has in fact converted from Islam, is that a crime or not? Modern societies say, of course it isn't, and Islamic law particularly says, yes, it is. And there are also problems of defining what counts as converting from Islam, because, of course, there are a variety of sects which consider themselves to be variants of Islam, but which many Muslims consider to be heretical or outside Islam and so forth. So if you join one of those, how do you count? Don't think I see any. All right. Questions so far before we go on to talk about theft, which is the other one where Islamic societies get a bad rap and their defenders try to defend them against it. So on the stuff so far, we've talked about things that occur to you that are interesting. Nothing in particular. All right. So to me, this is interesting as some things in Jewish law are, because it's the problem when you're stuck with a divinely dictated legal system. All right, that if you believe that parts of your legal system are God's word, well, you don't get to edit God's word. But sometimes they're parts you don't like. That presumably even modern Orthodox Jews feel a little queasy about the idea that if their kid gives them some lip, they're supposed to execute him, which appears to be what the Bible says, more or less. And similarly, a lot of modern Muslims think the idea that if we catch you, you know, picking somebody's pocket for a dollar, we should cut off your hand, is a little excessive. And maybe, depending on who you believe, and I'm never sure who to believe in these things, this is a problem that's been going on for a long time, in the sense that there seem to be a variety of hedges, of requirements, such that even though in theory theft results in Quranic punishment of having your hand cut off, it really mostly doesn't. It's interesting to compare it to the British 18th century British one, because we another one where which sort of gets a bad rap is the so-called Bloody Code in England in the 18th century, where the claim is that you committed any significant crime, including stealing stuff, and they hang you. And as I've discussed before, that's an exaggeration, that if you stole any substantial amount, you were at risk of being hanged, but you were a good deal more likely to be transported or pardoned or enlisted in the army or something of that sort, so you might get hanged. The rule for the English case is that in order for it to be possible for your offense to be capital, you had to steal more than one shilling. Other than that, it's petty larceny. And that what made it automatically capital was if you stole more than 40 shillings. But there were some other cases that just stealing less than 40 shillings from a house occupied by people at night where you were putting them in fear, and I think a variety of others that I don't remember. And what? Sorry, what was that? No. And I was sort of curious how that compared with the Islamic rule, trying to convert prices, because I've got it in here somewhere, that one of the requirements, depending on which school, was the amount stolen had to be above some minimal amount. And the amounts mentioned were 3, 5, and 10 dirhams. And, of course, we don't have exchange rates between, like, 9th century Arabic currency and 18th century English currency, but we do know that both of them used silver and gold as part of the monetary system, and we know roughly what the exchange rate between silver and gold were, and mining technology hadn't changed that much, so we might guess that the amount of labor it took to dig out and refine an ounce of silver wasn't too different between the two societies. So if you convert using the precious metal equivalent, you'll probably get a very, very rough idea of the equivalent. So I tried doing that. And a dirham is about 3 grams. I should have brought a dirham in to show you. And so we're talking 30 grams roughly is an ounce, so we're talking about roughly a third of an ounce to an ounce of silver makes your, the other requirements makes your theft the hot offense of theft. And that's silver, and roughly speaking, through quite a lot of past history, the price ratio of gold to silver was about 10 to 1. It's much higher now, but for some reason it was lower then. So that's equivalent to about a 30th of a gram to a 10th of a gram of silver. And I looked up the price of, got this here somewhere, yes, in 1800, gold in 1800, an ounce of gold was about $19, which was about 3 pounds, 16 shillings, given the then exchange rate between dollars and British and American money. And so it works out that, roughly speaking, 1 ounce of gold, for the chemist here, AU is gold, circa 1800, if I did my calculations correctly, which I don't swear I did, it's about 76 shillings. Hence, the high end of this is a tenth of an ounce of gold, so we're talking about something like 7.6 shillings on the high end. Let's call it 2.5, 7.5 So that suggests very roughly the amount of money it took to make your theft in medieval Islam a had offense was somewhat more than the amount at which it couldn't possibly be a capital offense, but a good deal less than the amount at which it automatically was capital. Now, of course, a had offense isn't capital. You only lose your hand, not your head. But nonetheless, it's a pretty serious punishment. So anyway, as I've said before, I think it's at least worth, when you can, trying to do these rough calculations so that you get a scale for things. It's not of enormous importance, but I like to do it when making sense of things. So, what are the requirements? There are a whole list of requirements, at least according to Forte. I don't know whether they apply in all schools of law and whether they're debatable or not. First, the victim has to charge you, as in the earlier set of offenses. Second, if you returned what you stole before you were charged, you are not guilty of the had offense of theft. Third, if you gave it back before you were charged. I steal something from you. Maybe you know I've stolen it. Maybe you run after me, but you haven't done whatever you have to do to file a charge. Like, oops, I'm sorry, you have it back. I've done something wrong, and I may be punished under some other part of the law, but I don't get my hand cut off. And the variety of other other requirements, you have to be an adult. It doesn't apply to kids. That their definition of adult isn't necessarily ours. The adult might mean just past puberty, depending on when and where you are. You have to be mentally competent. Somebody who's feeble-minded or lunatic is not guilty of a had offense, even if he steals. You have to have done it intentionally. If somebody was threatening to kill you if you didn't steal that stuff, then you're not guilty of the offense. And there is a necessity defense. And the necessity defense is the view which lots of people hold that it's not wrong for a starving man to steal food. Yeah?
The intent was really free will or voluntariness?
Yeah.
I mean,
yes, that is to say that you aren't being compelled to it in some way. Yeah. And so they usually interpret it that if you steal perishable food, it's automatically assumed that you are a starving man stealing food to eat, and therefore, again, you are not guilty of that, of the hot offense of theft. Furthermore, sort of an interesting one from our standpoint, is the good that is stolen must be property. It must be chattel whose title is enforceable at law. So, among other things, land is not chattel whose title is enforceable law. It's not chattel at all. It's real estate. So, therefore, if I steal your land, which I suppose I, that's quite how I steal the land, because they distinguish between theft and robbery. And it, as in the Icelandic case, theft is secret. So, I don't know quite how I go about secretly stealing your land. But I suppose I could imagine I move some boundary markers when nobody's looking or something like that. That doesn't count because land is real estate, not chattel. Furthermore, I gather I'm not properly allowed to enforce my property right in things that as a good Muslim I'm not allowed to use, like wine and pork, and therefore if I understand the rule correctly, stealing wine or pork is not theft for purposes of the had rule. And perhaps most interesting is that according to most schools, kidnapping is not theft. Because after all, a child is not a chattel. He's not a piece of property, therefore you can't steal him. Nor is stealing a theft. A stealing is a slave. A slave is in certain senses property, but he doesn't count for these purposes as property. The theft must be by stealth, as I said, and the property must be property to which the thief has no colorable claim. So if I say what I stole was property that my father left me in the inheritance, but you got a crooked judge to give it to you instead, then I've still committed a crime, assuming that I can't prove that it's mine, but I had a colorable claim it was mine, I believed it was mine, and therefore I have not committed the hot offense. And apparently, I'm not sure I believe it, but according to Forte, according to one school of law, all I have to do is to claim that I thought it was mine, which sounds like a get-out-of-jail-free card if I ever heard one, which may or may not be right. Furthermore, you generally can't be counted as having committed the offense for stealing books, because people who steal books don't want paper, they want the contents. and the contents is not property, the contents is ideas. That, again, seems rather weird. There was an early computer law case, which in a sense was the mirror image of that. And this was one where you've got a graduate student at Virginia Polytechnic Institute who is supposed to have the access to a computer to do his work. This is back when computers were big things that cost a fortune. But I think his outgoing thesis sponsor or something hadn't done the necessary things to give it to him, and he was embarrassed to go complain and get somebody else. So he got various other students to let him do his computing on their time and, you know, get keys to their boxes to get the printout and so forth. And he's caught and charged with a fairly serious offense by the state of Virginia of having stolen property worth, I don't know what, more than $500 or something. And eventually he is acquitted on the grounds that the paper that the printing was done on was worth much less than $500, and that the fact that he was stealing services worth much more didn't come under the statute. The BPI gave him his PhD, so it's pretty clear they didn't take it seriously. But it's an interesting case in terms of computer law, because it's sort of an early case of how you fit computer services into the general structure of law having to do with that. But anyway, that's sort of turning it around from their view that it isn't the paper that you've stolen, it's the ideas, and ideas may be intellectual property, but I don't think there is intellectual property. As far as I know, there's no equivalent of patent or copyright law in this system. And what are the requirements? Two witnesses of good character. I don't think they have to be Muslims, though I'm not sure. Or two confessions by the thief. And all of this, again, is not for punishing you for theft, but for punishing you for theft by cutting your hand off. That is the hot offense of theft. All right, there's then a long discussion that you've now read under the category of lost, strayed, or stolen, where part of, again, what interested me was seeing how this paralleled discussions in the Jewish law, where people really did seem to be seriously concerned about questions such as, you find a stray cow, what are you supposed to do? If you just, depends on the animal, but if it's a cow, arguably if you do nothing, it's going to starve to death or get attacked by wolves or something. On the other hand, if you take it and put it in your barn, have you stolen a cow that belongs to somebody else? The Islamic view, apparently, is that if it's something that can survive without care, such as the camel in the normal Arabian environment, then you're not supposed to take it, at least some schools, or you're not supposed to take it because there's too much suspicion you're stealing it, whereas if it's something that can't survive by itself, then you're obliged to take it in order to safeguard it for the owner. So all of that struck me as sort of an interesting set of issues, which more or less take the position that the lost property still belongs to the original owner, and you're a sort of a trustee, a bailee, somebody like someone who I've lent something to, even though it was not a voluntary transaction. So how do you recover lost property? What's the obvious way, and I think this is true in the Jewish law as well, we'd have to check. How do you, your cow has strayed, and I, being a responsible person, put the cow in my barn, and then had proclamation made at the mosque, every week, I have found a strayed cow in such and such a place. And you realize that you're missing a cow, so what do? That's right. You've got to give me information beyond the information I gave in my announcement that will convincingly show that it's your cow. Yep?
Could you then dispute that yourself by making the announcement sufficiently detailed?
Well, it's not entirely clear that you want to immunize yourself, but in any case, you're not supposed to. You're supposed to leave out enough stuff so the true owner can demonstrate it. And my memory in the Jewish law, I think they talk about packages and their wrappings and how they're wrapped and some of the kind of evidence that can be used to prove it, though obviously for a camel, you don't usually wrap up cows. The basic rule then you have this problem that you've been feeding this cow until the owner comes. And so the basic rule seems to be the owner now owes you what you spent on the cow. If the cow had a calf, the calf belongs to the original owner, not to you. On the other hand, if you milk the cow, you're allowed to consume the milk, because after all, that would have spoiled if you just left it anyway. So temporary benefits from the animal you can get, and I am not sure if you're supposed to set them against the cost of maintaining it or not. That's not entirely clear. And the basically the obligation of the finder is to act in the interest of the owner, which means that if the finder can't trust himself not to steal it, he should keep his hands off. But if he can, he should protect it and has that a fiduciary duty to deal with it. Now, some of these issues, of course, show up in our law as well. And I'm thinking now of the Good Samaritan cases. The question is, under what circumstances am I either legally or morally obliged to help you sort of voluntarily, as it were? So what's the situation if I have an opportunity to save your life? I see you drowning and I can swim. Yep.
Is it only if you cause...
I think at least under common law, I think there may be state legislation in our country. Yep.
It will, if you had nothing to do with the misfortune, you're obliged only one to your help to not let leave the scene and the serving person will change the
scene. Right. So, and with regard, what about property? Similarly, the normal rule is that you're not obliged to save somebody else's property. In that sense, I think it's weaker obligation than the Islamic rule. And that, like, I think the Islamic rule is that you morally are obliged and you might be legally obliged. Yeah?
Can you have some rules about finding stuff where you don't, if you find popular in certain circumstances, you don't owe it to the true owner, or is that not the case?
I don't remember any cases. There are cases where you've consumed, first, if it's below some amount, I think you don't have to take care of it. And I think if its upkeep is going to cost more than it's worth, you're entitled to sell it, but you then are supposed to give the money to the owner when and if he shows up.
But what if you find like $10 on a crowded public street?
There's no way of identifying it. Yeah, that's a good question. I think, though, I am not sure. Let me see, I have some notes on this, and I'm not sure where...
From the overall circumstance, whether it was mislaid or not.
But I don't think there's a loss. There's in the Jewish law, there's an interesting distinction according to whether or not you believe the owner has given up hope of recovering it.
Right.
Was that here too? I didn't remember that. Where?
I was just sort of looking through
my notes on this, because I don't have the book in front of me.
Right now,
oh, I'm sorry, about the common law or about the Islamic law? I'm sorry, I was talking about Islamic law and about Jewish law, and I don't remember that distinction in the Islamic law, although I do remember it in the Jewish law, the question of whether or not you think the person has given up hope, because one of the little bits I've actually got up on my webpage is a quote of the month or something that I thought was funny in Maimonides, is that Maimonides says that if your property has been stolen by a robber, a highwayman, if he's a Jewish robber, you then are assumed to have given up hope of getting it back. But if he's a Gentile robber, you aren't assumed to have given up hope in that. Why is this? Because we know that the Gentile courts have lousy standards of proof. They're willing to give people on what we would consider inadequate evidence, therefore you might get your property back. Which I thought was sort of a bizarre twist to his view, at least, of the difference between Jewish and Gentile courts. If the owner doesn't show up for a year, one of the things you can do is to give the property an alms, acting theoretically as an agent for the unknown owner. And you can appropriate it for your own use, although presumably you'll still owe the owner if he ever shows up. And you can keep on holding it. Well, except if I understand it, it looks to me as though the statute, well, depends. The 1 year statute of limitations, I think, is only that you can start treating it as your property, but if he does show up, you still owe it to him. But this mentions that at least in one of the schools of law, there is a 3 year limit after which you don't have to return it at all, if I've got that correctly. So at that point, you have full ownership. I was noticing I have a little bit more of a note on this apostasy stuff, which I've gotten the wrong place in my notes, so I didn't mention it before, and that is that it's suggested that what's going on historically with the apostasy issue is this really treason. because what did happen when Muhammad died was you had various Arab tribes that had agreed to convert to Islam and become Muslims, and then Muhammad died, they said, oops, maybe they aren't going to be able to make us do it after all, switched back to paganism, the Muslims successfully made war on them, and so the view may be that, in effect, if you were a Muslim, you owed allegiance to Islam, and you've now abandoned that. And so I gather that the minority view in Islamic law is that it's only the combination of apostasy plus rebellion. So that if you say, I am now a Christian, and here is the poll tax, and yes, I gave away my sword, so I'm not allowed to carry a sword as a Christian, and I cut my turban shorter because my turban was longer than Christians were allowed to wear, and I dyed it blue because Christians were supposed to have blue turbans, then you haven't rebelled, you've just changed religion. And a minority view holds that's not punishable, a majority view holds we still execute you. So anyway, I think I've got more stuff we could discuss about out of time, and as far as I can see, we've covered most of what's there. So read the reading on Jewish law, which is on reserve for the library for Tuesday, and by hopefully Monday I will have my essay on Jewish law, which is what I would like to have found as a sense of a 5 or 10 day summary of what's going on. And you all, of course, have paper topics by now, and if not, you should hide your heads in shame, or at least come talk to me, and I will see you on Tuesday.